Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover. We're glad you joined us tonight to welcome Sophie Hannah with her latest book this evening, which was last year shortlisted for the Specsavers Best Crime Fiction of the Year. So now we'll listen to her and hear more about the latest Zahler and Waterhouse stories.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's really lovely to be here and such a nice atmospheric bookstore. It's really great to be here. What I thought I would do is I will obviously talk to you a bit about Kind of Cruel, but what I like to do when I do a book talk is tell you the gossip behind the book, because I always figure that, you know, you can pick up the book and read what the story's about on your own without the writer there to tell you that. But what you can't do, unless you've got a very indiscreet writer willing to dish the dirt, is find out what made that particular writer want to write that particular book. And all of my books start from something in real life. I always have a sort of idea for an intriguing opening mystery, which always is inspired by something that's preoccupying me in real life. So first of all, I'll just tell you very quickly about the sort of plot of Kind of Cruel. The heroine, Amber, is an insomniac, and she hasn't slept properly for 18 months, ever since her friend Sharon died in an arson attack. So something about Sharon's death, the police haven't found who set fire to her house, something about that has been bothering Amber, and has been preventing her from sleeping properly. Also, when Sharon died, Sharon's two daughters went to live with Amber because Sharon had a will saying that in the event of her untimely death, she wanted Amber, her best friend, to inherit her children. So Amber has got these two children, and Amber and her husband Luke are trying to sort of cope with this new situation. Slightly problematic because Luke didn't know that Amber had agreed to take on these children. She hadn't mentioned it to him. And then one day, lo and behold, they turn up. And Amber has to say, well, yeah, I'm sorry, I did agree to have these children, which was based on real life, but I'll come back to that. So Amber goes to see a hypnotherapist in the hope that this will help with her insomnia. And under hypnosis, she hears herself saying this strange sequence of words. She hears herself saying, kind, cruel, kind of cruel. She has no idea why she said it, where these words came from, what they mean. I mean, obviously she knows what the words kind and cruel mean, but it seems like such a sort of distinctive phrase, kind, cruel, kind of cruel. She knows she's got it from somewhere, but she just doesn't know where. And this really freaks her out. So she goes home from her hypnotherapy session feeling a bit bemused and puzzled. A couple of hours later, some police detectives show up at her door and arrest her for the murder of a woman she's never heard of. And Amber soon discovers that the reason this has happened is that the same words, kind, cruel, kind of cruel, were the only clue found at the scene of a local unsolved murder. And Amber has no idea how the police can possibly know that she said these words in a confidential hypnotherapy session. So then she has to try and help the police by finding out where she got these words from, just in case it has any bearing on the murder. So that's the basic story and the sort of central mystery. There's also a subsidiary mystery, because, you know, for me as a writer, my main interest is in the mystery, in creating that feeling in the reader of I'm just desperate to know what the hell's going on here. Because that's how I always want to feel when I'm reading a book. So I always put in more than one mystery. I think one mystery is not quite enough. And I also think that mysteries that begin with a dead body are not quite enough. Because as soon as you've met the dead body, you might not know who killed them and why, But you pretty much know what's going on. Someone's killed them. The chances are they've done it because they didn't like them very much. So, you know, it's almost like half the mystery is solved before you even get started. So a subsidiary mystery in this novel is that 7 years before the action begins, Amber and her extended family hired a big house for Christmas so that all the branches of the family could be together at Christmas. And on Christmas morning, when everyone came downstairs, they found that one branch of the family, Amber's brother-in-law and his wife and their two children, had completely disappeared from the house. And they were the ones whose idea it was to... They were the ones who rented the house. So they were kind of the hosts, really, and they'd completely disappeared. Their presents were there. Children's presents were still there by the tree. No one had been left any messages. There was no scribbled note. They'd just gone. So everyone gets very worried, and the police say, oh, you know, don't worry until they've been missing for 24 hours, which is what the police always say, which is it's a bit silly, really. I mean, if you're a punctual person who's good at admin, then really people need to worry if you've been missing for 10 minutes, you know, if you're the sort of person who never would be missing for 10 minutes. Anyway, Boxing Day morning, everyone comes downstairs again after a tense and worried night to find that this branch of the family, Joe and Neil and their two sons, have reappeared. There they are in the kitchen looking suspiciously fine. And so everyone says, what happened? And Joe says, let's all gather together and I will address you all as one. So they all gather together expecting to hear an explanation. And instead of an explanation, Joe says, we're back, we're fine, we're sorry that we disappeared. We're not saying anything about what happened. Don't ask us, ever. Let's just go on as if nothing ever happened. So this mystery of what happened to Joe and Neil and the boys, where did they go? Why did they come back? What was that all about? Amber has never been able to get that out of her mind. And everyone else in the family that she periodically mentions it to, you know, says, she says, you know, it's a bit strange, wasn't it, what happened a few years ago? And everyone says, oh, well, you know, it's their private business. All that matters is they're okay and they came back. But Amber doesn't think that's all that matters. Amber thinks she really wants to know. She has a feeling that there is something wrong in the family. She can't put her finger on what it is. She has a vague sense that it might be connected to the murder of Sharon, her best friend. And all of this is what she hopes will be resolved by going to see a hypnotherapist. And instead, she ends up in an even bigger mess because she says these strange words and ends up getting arrested. So that's the plot. Now, I'll tell you the two gossipy stories that led to me thinking of that plot. The first one involves inheriting children. So about probably 5 or 6 years ago, when my children were quite little, I was at a literary party, drinking a glass of wine, as you do, and this acquaintance of mine, I wouldn't even call her a friend, she was somebody I saw at literary parties, sort of sidled up to me and said, hi, how are you? She also had a glass of wine. Fine, great to see you. She said, can we just come over into a private corner? Because I want to have a word with you. I said, okay. She said, and I'm going to get my husband as well, because he needs to be here to listen to this. And I thought, have I had an affair with your husband? What's going on? This all seems a bit heavy and serious. I'm sure I would remember if I'd had an affair with your husband. So we went off into the corner, and she said, now, I know this will seem like it's coming out of the blue, but we're making our wills, and we need to think about who we would want to be the guardian of our children in the event of our untimely death. And we both hate our entire families. And, you know, to cut to the chase, we can't think of anyone we would rather have inherit our children than you. And, you know, obviously feel free to say no. But, you know, would you do us the honour of agreeing to be the guardian of our children? And I'm sort of thinking, hang on a minute. I've met this woman like 4 times in my entire life. She's never met my husband. For all she knows, my husband could be a frothing-at-the-mouth psychopath. Why does she want her children to come and live with us? We've got quite a nice house, but surely it can't just boil down to that. I think it did actually just boil down to that, actually. But anyway, I have this real weird sort of social hang-up, which is I just cannot bear socially awkward situations. I'm just so sensitive to any tension, and I always feel it's my responsibility to smooth it over. So I'm a real pacifier. And it's actually helpful at book events. You know, occasionally, usually people who come to my events come because they like my book, so nothing bad usually happens. But occasionally you get someone who comes along to tell you that they hate every word you've ever written. And some authors get upset when these things happen and sort of go off and cry. But because I'm so diplomatic and I hate social awkwardness, on the rare occasions when people do come up to me and say, you know, I absolutely hate all your books and how dare you write them, I always respond by saying, oh, thank you for that fascinating feedback. Yes, you're probably right. Well, you know, I'm sorry about writing my books and everything, but hope we can still be friends. And, you know, I'll go out of my way to make everything okay. And so there I was in this situation, and I just thought, right, obviously I can't say no. There is just no way of saying no. You can't do it in a light-hearted way. Nah, I don't really fancy having your kids if you die, soz. That doesn't sound very good, and you can't do it in a sort of sombre way. The message is still the same. The message is still, no, on balance, I'd rather they went to an orphanage, and it doesn't sound good. So I just thought, I've got to say yes. You say yes in these situations. So I said, oh, absolutely, how flattering, marvellous, great. And I was thinking, this is fine. They're not going to die. They're both really healthy looking. And, you know, I'd rather they laid off the wine a bit in the light of this conversation. But, you know, they seem in good nick. So I said yes. And they said, oh, great, we'll get our wills drawn up next week. And then I sort of went off and forgot about it and succeeded in putting it out of my mind for several weeks. Occasionally, I sort of felt vaguely uneasy around the edges at what I'd agreed to. But I just sort of pushed the thought away. And then one night, I sort of woke up in the middle of the night, and I suddenly thought, it doesn't matter how healthy they are. What if they're both crossing the street and they get mown down by a truck? Or what if they're on an aeroplane together without the kids and the plane crashes? I mean, anything could happen to them. And I started getting paranoid about the chances of them dying. And I realised that the thing that was really worrying me was that I hadn't mentioned any of this to my husband. And I thought, it's not going to happen. It's definitely not going to happen. But imagine if it happened. He would be quite cross that I'd agreed to take on these kids without checking with him. Even though generally I don't check stuff with him because he wouldn't be that interested anyway, but that would be the kind of thing that he would definitely think I should have mentioned. So I thought, right, I'll just mention it to him and he'll reassure me that it's nothing to worry about and that they won't die and it'll all be fine. So I waited till a time when I thought he almost definitely wouldn't be listening properly. And I said, you know, oh, you know, it's probably fine, but I've agreed that we'll take on these kids. And he said, what? You've done what? My husband doesn't have any fear of social awkwardness, by the way. He often enjoys creating it himself. He said, but so you'd actually be willing to have their kids come and live with us and bring them up? I mean, how would that be? I said, well, no, obviously I wouldn't really be willing to have the kids. He said, well, then what's the plan? They die. Kids turn up with their suitcases. What do we do? I said, well, it'll be fine because then they'll be dead. So there'll be no social awkwardness to worry about. I just won't open the door when the kids turn up. And he said, no, that isn't that a bit worse? Surely having a difficult conversation now, which would enable them to make proper arrangements for their children, would be better than pretending you'll bring up their children and then secretly planning to send them to an orphanage. So I said, no, I don't think that would be better because all I care about is avoiding social awkwardness now. Anyway, he forced me to ring up and say that we wouldn't have the kids. But he did allow me to blame it on him. So I said, you know, I would love nothing more than to bring up your children, but my husband just won't hear of it. So that was... That part of the inspiration, the idea of somebody agreeing to have their friend's children but not telling their husband. And I kind of became fascinated with this whole thing of children being left to other people in wills. And I asked around a few of my friends, has anyone ever asked you to be the guardian of their children? Everybody said yes. Oh, yeah, oh, God, we're down to inherit Mary and we're down to inherit Tommy. And I said to all of them, you know, and would that be okay if it happened? Oh, God, no, it'd ruin my life. So that was quite interesting. I mean, basically everyone is agreeing to inherit children that they really would not want to inherit at all. So I don't think I will bother leaving my children to anyone, since they'd probably be lying if they said they wanted them anyway. So that was one source of inspiration. Now, the other source of inspiration for the other mystery in the book, which is, you know, the family disappearing and reappearing. I was quite interested in that from a sort of narrative point of view, because I think people going missing is a real staple of crime fiction. It's almost a cliche of the genre. Somebody goes missing and either you never find them or they're found dead a few weeks later. But they don't usually come back immediately afterwards and still maintain the mystery by refusing to say where they've been. And I really like this as a sort of narrative device, because I thought, actually, it's more frustrating. So if they're just missing, you can't ask them where they are, obviously, because they're not there. But if they've come back and they're standing there right next to you, knowing exactly what happened and refusing to tell you, that's far more suspenseful, I thought. So I really like this idea of them being back in a way that deepens the mystery rather than solves it. Because actually, it doesn't matter where they are physically. What matters is why did they go and what happened. So that was sort of from a narrative point of view. From a personal point of view, the inspiration for that strand of the story, again, came from my personal experience. For about the last 10 or 11 years, my house has been the house where all the extended family gathers at Christmas. And in fact, it's my house is the common theme here. That's why that woman wanted to leave me her children. That's why all the relatives descend on me at Christmas. My life would be so much easier if I had a worse house. I don't know how it happened that everyone comes to me for Christmas every year. I remember inviting everyone one year. And somehow that was mistaken for a permanent invitation. And it's kind of, there is no other house in the extended family where everyone would fit. So it's just kind of taken as read. And normally it's absolutely fine. I love having guests and it's all great. But when my children were little, they went through a phase of waking up very early, sort of 5 or 6 in the morning. And that was really tough, having to get up with 2 children at 5 a.m., be awake with them and dealing with them till everyone else got up at sort of 10 a.m., and then having to cook loads of meals and run the house and entertain everyone. And so this happened for a couple of years, and I was just getting more and more bitter and resentful about it. And one Christmas Eve, I got into bed and I knew that I would have to make the Christmas dinner the next day after having got up at 5 a.m. And nobody in the extended family, and there was like 27 people in the house, not one of them at any point said, why don't we get up with the kids one morning and give you a chance to have a lie-in? And so I was starting to listen for every word that came out of their mouths, and every word that came out of their mouths that were not those precise words were really starting to rankle with me. And Christmas Eve, one particular year, I got into bed and found that I couldn't lie down because I was just set in a rectangle of resentment. So I woke my husband up. He was snoring next to me. It was about midnight on Christmas Eve. Woke him up and he said, what? I said, get the kids, bundle them up in blankets, stick them in the car, we're going. He said, what? I said, we're going to run away. We're going to disappear. And he said, but this is our house. I said, I know, that's the whole point. It wouldn't be as much fun disappearing from someone else's house. And I thought, you know, this, you can tell that he's not a writer. You know, if you go and stay with someone else and then you leave in the middle of the night, that's kind of mildly interesting. But if you're the host, if you invite everyone to congregate in your house in order to cook Christmas dinner for them, and then you disappear, leaving them hostless, that's much more compelling from a narrative point of view. So I really wanted to do this. And he said, no, I'm not doing it. You know, where would we go? I said, it doesn't matter where we'd go. We can go to a hotel. Just stay away for Christmas Day, come back on Boxing Day morning and, you know, get on with our holiday. And he said, but where would we say we'd been? I thought, yeah, actually, he's got a point there. That would be a bit of a problem. Where would we say we'd been? And then I had a brilliant idea. I said, I know what we'll do. We'll just do the traumatised face. You know, when you really want to know some essential gossip about somebody's private life and you ask them, or if you're me, you ask them, you say, so what happened in between when he hit you over the head with a vase and when you threw the custard pie at him? What happened? And annoyingly, people will often then do the traumatized face and go, I'm sorry, it's just too upsetting, I just can't bear to talk about it. And it's an absolutely sort of global, universal signal. Once someone's done the traumatized face, you have to stop asking them questions. Otherwise, you look really crass and insensitive. So I said, we'll just do the traumatized face. And he said, no, I'm not doing any of that. I'm going back to sleep. You go to sleep as well, and we'll just sort it out in the morning. So that was what we did. And in the morning, I woke everyone up at 6 a.m. and said, I'm really cross with you all. This is actually my one moment of social honesty. I said, you know, I just can't keep getting up at 5 a.m. and cooking all the meals all day. So someone else is going to have to weigh in and help a bit. So that was all fine. They all agreed. The rest of the holiday was more relaxing. I still resented them because I'd had to tell them rather than them having the idea on their own steam. But still, at least I didn't have to get up early. But that was where that aspect of the plot came from. And so this is how I work with all my books, really. Something will happen in real life. And it's usually something that I'm either too scared or too lazy to actually do. But in my head, I kind of think, but what if someone did do that? Or what if someone did something a bit like that? And that's really how all my books come into being. So I think that's probably all I need to tell you about the book. There's a description. Oh, no, I'll tell you one more thing. Again, another personal thing. I needed to do research into hypnotherapy because I knew I was going to be writing about it. So I went to see a hypnotherapist and I said, I'm a crime writer. I'm writing a book that features hypnotherapy and I've never been hypnotized. I'm not convinced that I ever could be. But can you try and hypnotize me and I'll pay your usual rate? And I said, since you'll need something to hypnotize me about, why don't you hypnotise me to eat less? Because I've heard that hypnotherapy is good for that kind of thing. So just, you know, get me in a proper trance and say, stop eating cream cakes and, you know, and that'll be great. And she looked at me in a sort of searching, psychotherapeutic way. And she said, why? Are you saying you eat too much? And I said, well, yeah, I mean, clearly I eat too much. She said, why do you think you eat too much? I said, well, because basically I'm a hedonist with no willpower. So if something's going to be pleasurable, that's really my only consideration and I always do it. This has got me into much trouble over the years of various kinds. She said, ah, interesting. So you like things to be pleasurable, do you? I said, yes. Isn't that normal? She said, well, she said, I notice that you're trying to entertain me. Are you trying to be entertaining? I said, well, I'm just answering your questions. And she said, ah, but you're answering them in an entertaining way. I said, well, yeah, because, you know, I'm taking up your time. I thought I should, you know, try and make it a bit jolly for you rather than just sort of bore you to death or be really gloomy. She said, interesting that you feel obliged to entertain people. I said, well, I kind of do feel obliged to entertain people, actually, because if I stop doing that, then I have no income and I'm living under a bridge for the rest of my life. So it's quite important. She said, I think that if we had proper hypnotherapy, so not just one session, but at least 20 sessions of proper psychoanalytic hypnotherapy, I think we would find that you're repressing a key memory from early childhood. And if we can uncover this memory, it will explain everything. It'll explain why you eat too much and why you try to be entertaining and everything you've said. So I said, well, I'm not sure there is. She said, oh, there is. She said, I've met many people like you. They all have a repressed key memory. It usually emerges around about session number 15. So she kind of hooked me with that cliffhanger, really. I thought, well, I don't believe there is anything, but just in case there might be, if it's to do with me and my life, I'd quite like to know about it. So I signed up for these extra sessions, which was very entertaining. And the funny thing was, it was quite effective in terms of coming up with stuff that it's not that I'd forgotten, but memories that I just didn't know were there suddenly popped up. And there were some quite good ones as well of official traumatic things. But every time I came up with one of these and said, do you think it's that? She said, no, it's definitely not that. That's a good one, but it's not the one. I said, how can you tell if it's the one? That was, you know, a pretty bad thing. When I think about it, I'm quite cross about that. She said, no, it's not the one. And everything I came up with turned out not to be the one. And eventually I thought, I can't just keep coming back here and paying £100 a time on the promise of this key memory. So in the end, I stopped. I mean, we were very good friends by the end of this whole process. She thought I was a nightmare client because I wanted to analyse everything myself. So I'd be lying there coming up with the memories, and then I'd sit bolt upright and go, I know what that means. And she'd say, I'm the one who's supposed to say, I know what that means. So that was great. And actually having those sessions of psychotherapy that I wasn't expecting to have really helped with the research for the book, because the book is all about dysfunctional families. And all my books are about sort of scary and dangerous and dysfunctional personal relationships. So none of my protagonists are ever being chased by the FBI, the CIA, the mob, never anything like that. The people who my characters are in danger from is always their mother, their father, their husband, their wife, their lover, their children. It's always personal. Because I think, you know, that's the danger most people face. You know, most people are unlikely to be targeted by a serial killer with a strange, cryptic preference for psalms from the Bible. But everybody is in some way screwed up by their close personal relationships. And so I think that's why I like to write about that kind of thing. So that's the gossip behind Kind of Cruel. Does anyone have any questions about books, dysfunctional families, and how to deal with them? I assume nobody wants to leave me their children after I've demonstrated how unmaternal I am. Yes.
I really enjoy those backstories. And I'm wondering if there is a great example of a backstory that happened in real life that you've really tried to get into a book but just hasn't worked for you? Something really crazy that happened?
That's interesting. Has there ever been a good gossip story from real life that I haven't managed to work into a book? There's one, and I don't know whether it's too comic to be a good backstory for one of my books, because my books are quite dark and sinister. But something that did really happen to me and was just hilarious. Before I wrote crime fiction, I was a poet for 10 years. I still write poetry, but for these 10 years, I was kind of only and mainly a poet. And I used to do lots of speaking events, because that's how poets make their living, really, sort of go around appearing at literature festivals and at local libraries and stuff. And I'd been invited to talk in Peterborough, which is a city in sort of the middle of England, in this hotel. And the reading was taking place in a sort of quite grand room, a sort of function room in this hotel. So I was standing at the front reading, and I'd probably read about three poems. The audience, the chairs were sort of like this, and the audience were all sitting there listening. I was reading, and I'd got about three poems into my set when the door, which was sort of over there behind the audience, the door was flung open so that it bashed against the wall. And everyone kind of went, huh. And a man, sort of bathed in sweat, desperate-looking man, ran in. I mean, literally, it was as though his life depended on getting into that room. Ran past the audience, and there were the only available seats were in the front row. And he sort of hurled himself into a seat and sat there like this, dripping sweat, going, sorry, sorry. So I waited until he'd calmed down. And I could see that people were a bit sort of disturbed, right, you know, sweaty, desperate-looking chap who'd just arrived late. I was really flattered. I was like, wow. You know, this is how dedicated this guy is to the cause of getting to my poetry reading. It matters so much to him that he doesn't miss my reading at the hotel in Peterborough. He must have run all the way from Scunthorpe. You know, maybe his car broke down and maybe he just abandoned it by the side of the road and ran all the way to Peterborough. So for the rest of my set, I was sort of directing the poems at everyone, but I was kind of specially reading to him. By the end of the set, you know how you kind of go off on these weird imaginative journeys? I was thinking, you know, maybe he's in love with me. Maybe I'm in love with him. Once the sweat's dried, he doesn't look too bad. Constructing this whole narrative based on how we were destined to be together forever. And then I finished, and everyone clapped, including him. And then there was a knock on the door, and he kind of went, as though, like, suddenly he was tense again. The door opened, three policemen walked in and arrested him, and he'd robbed the fruit machine. You know those machines that you play games on and they give you money if you win? He'd robbed the fruit machine in the hotel bar. Someone had called the police. The police had been chasing him around the hotel. He'd seen this room, and he just thought, I've got to get in there and hide from the police. And the reason he was looking so delighted when he sat down and got sort of swept up into this poetry reading was that it was such a brilliant hiding place, you know. So I've no idea whether he enjoyed the poems as a byproduct of hiding from the police. But that I thought was just a hilarious story. And I mean, I always use everything. So my latest book that's out in the UK at the moment, which is called The Carrier, which is coming out here next year, starts with a woman whose plane is delayed overnight. And so all the passengers are taken by coach to a hotel. And at the hotel, the receptionist says to them, I'm terribly sorry, I wasn't expecting a plane load of people. And I haven't got enough rooms for you all. Anyone travelling alone will have to share with a stranger. And the heroine, Gabby, at that point is kind of grabbed by a very unstable-looking young woman who says, you're sharing with me. And this young woman turns out to be in a terrible state and starts wittering on about some man that she knows who's been charged with a murder that he didn't commit, and he's innocent and he's going to prison. And so Gabby sort of tries to investigate this a bit further and soon finds out that this innocent man going to prison for the murder of his wife is the only man that she, Gabby, has ever really loved. And then she thinks, hang on a minute, can this be a coincidence? This woman targets me, says she wants to share a room with me, and now she knows that the love of my life has apparently murdered his wife. This can't be a coincidence. So that's the premise of The Carrier. That's how it starts. And that really happened to me. Apart from the murder bit, I had a plane. I was in Germany. My plane was delayed overnight. I went outside to wait for the coach that was going to take us to a hotel, and there was a young woman there with an enormous packet of cigarettes, like one of those ones that's like 100 packets of cigarettes all welded together. And I thought this would be a good time to take up smoking. So I asked her if I could buy a packet of cigarettes from her. She said, oh, don't be silly, have one, I've got plenty. I said, oh, thank you so much, great. Took a packet of cigarettes, went and stood at a polite and safe distance. And 10 seconds later, she burst into tears, dropped all her cigarettes on the floor, ran over to me, flung herself into my arms and said, I'm having a panic attack, I'm falling apart, and you have to look after me. And then it just went from bad to worse. We went to the hotel, we had to share a room. She wouldn't let me share. You know, the receptionist really did say, anyone travelling alone will have to share with a stranger. And I thought, great, this is a fantastic opportunity. But no, because Psycho Helen had latched onto me, and she thought it would be a brilliant opportunity to latch onto me even further. And so I just had this horrendous night where she was just basically, you know, just barking mad and being very aggressive to the other passengers on the plane. I mean, she was really quite unstable, and I was trying to smooth everything over, following her around, apologising to everyone she offended. And so that was the basis for the book. And, you know, I think if these weird things didn't happen in real life, I wouldn't have the ideas for books that I do have. Yes?
Has anyone who's been the subject of your inspiration ever figured it out, read your book, or?
Has anyone that's inspired one of my books ever figured it out? I think the answer must be yes. But generally there's some reason why they don't mention it. Either I'm not speaking to them anymore, or they're not speaking to me anymore. If it's like an ex-boyfriend or somebody, I often write about ex-boyfriends. Two of my worst psychopaths in my novels were inspired by the same ex-boyfriend, and he definitely knows about that. But since we're not on speaking terms, he can't say anything about it. I think people sometimes know. But as somebody said on Twitter, and it was a quote from somebody on Twitter, which I'm addicted to, quoted a writer, and they didn't know which writer, but apparently this writer said to somebody who'd complained about ending up in one of their books, this writer said, well, if you didn't want to end up in a book, you should have behaved better. which I think is quite a good aphorism. Words to live by. Yes. Does my husband ever get annoyed that I share all the gossip? He's very sort of mild-mannered and tolerant, my husband. I mean, he's much more normal than I am. And occasionally he'll say slightly irritably, why can't you just be more normal? Often when I tell him about the various strange situations I've ended up in, he'll just look at me in horror and say, you see, that kind of thing would just never happen to me. Because he just sort of goes about behaving normally, keeps his head down, nobody ever accosts him. He doesn't end up getting embroiled in strange situations, whereas I'm constantly on the lookout for strange situations. If there's something weird, interesting, melodramatic going on, I'll go and stand next to it and, you know. And then, obviously, I often get dragged into it. But no, he's very tolerant. The one thing he doesn't like is if he comes to my events, which he very occasionally does, he doesn't like the fact that I'll often work him into my routine. And because he'll say, you know, you think it's just your routine. But in the interval, loads of people came up to me and interrogated me about that thing that you said I did. And loads of people came and commiserated with me about being married to you. And I'd rather not have that kind of attention. So now he just doesn't really come to my events. Or if he does, then I try not to mention him specifically.
Does he read your books?
Yes, my husband reads all my books, but he doesn't read them until they're published and out. So he reads them, you know, just as a reader would, rather than before they're edited. Because I wouldn't want him to see them at too early a stage when they still need editorial input, because he's not very tactful. At the one time he read something before it was polished and perfected, he read the first draft of my very, very first attempt at a novel, which was, it was a bit of a mess, because it was, you know, first time I'd tried writing a novel. It wasn't very sort of finessed. But he started reading it. He liked the beginning. And then obviously something happened where he thought it had gone wrong a bit. And instead of saying, as any tactful editor would say, I really like this, but have you thought about maybe changing that? Because that would make it even better. You know, there's ways and ways of saying these things tactfully. He said, Soph, I'm reading your book. I mean, it started so well. And then you just ruined it. I mean, you know, it was going so well and then suddenly it just totally fell apart. I mean, why did you decide to make it so rubbish at the end? I'm like, yeah, I don't think this is going to go very well. I think from now on you can wait and read the edited version. Well, thank you very much for listening to me.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.